How my, hare my. Welcome to the Maxim Institute podcast. My name's Jason, and I'm the communications manager at Maxim. In this episode of the Maxim podcast, we're excited to present a recording of the launch event celebrating the release of Volume 10 of Flint and Steel, Social Media, Playground, Battlefield, Abyss. Our special guest is Jisoo Kim, former digital media advisor to Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and contributor to Volume 10. Jisoo explains how algorithms and surveillance capitalism shape the online experience. In conversation with our executive director, Tim Wilson, she'll unpack how tech giants access intimate details of our lives to feed us customized content. Jisoo breaks down the implications this has for democracy when big tech acts as information gatekeepers. While social media facilitates connecting niche groups globally, what does a healthy digital public square look like? How can we harness the upsides while avoiding the pitfalls? Let's dive into some key insights from Flint and Steel's 10th volume.
Well, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Nō mai, haere mai. Welcome to this event, the launch of the 10th edition of Flint and Steel. Woo! The title of the evening is Social Media, Playground, Battlefield, Abyss. And, well, that's the title of the Flint and Steel. By the way, has everyone got a copy of Flint and Steel yet? Just so, no! Oh, my goodness. Well, they're up there and they're for sale, so FYI. Listen, Maxim Institute is, people say, what's Maxim? And I say, it's a think tank. But basically, we just want to make our country a better place. We want to make it more just, free, compassionate, and hopeful, with the emphasis on the hopeful part, because there's not that much of that around. And you think, wow, well, that sounds like a great organization. How does it make its money? We don't. We're a charity. Throw money now, at once, all the money you've got. If you can, that would be awesome. But save some to buy a Flint and Steel. Look, we're going to be addressing the issue of social media, and your phone is listening very soon. And to help me here, I have with me Jisoo Kim. So put your hands together for Jisoo. Now, Jisoo is an amazing person. She was a social media advisor to Scott Morrison during the 2019 campaign. Fascinating time. And also, she's working in the national security space in the Australian Public Service currently. So she's got a lot of perspective, I think, on the issue of social media. As you know, the evening is titled "Your Phone is Listening," and we deliberately made it sound creepy to get you here, because actually we want to get into that, and we want to get into what it hears, who that information goes to, what they do with it, and what we can do about that. So the format of the evening is, after Jisoo and I have had a bit of a chat, there'll be a Q&A, and there'll be questions up on Slido. I'll walk you through it. It's fine, but questions will be voted. It will be, we will manage some of the questions. So, you know, if anything's inappropriate, but don't worry. You will see your questions rising as they attain popularity. After that, we're going to have a celebration, because this is actually the 10th Flint and Steel. So we're just going to attend to all of the incredible people who have helped with Flint and Steel, and we're going to hear from Flint and Steel's editor, Mr. Jason Heal, over there. So that's going to be a dangerous time, because Jason never comes in cold, he comes in hot. So you'll enjoy that. And by the way, look, for those of you who are on the clock, we'll probably be done by about 9:10. Okay, 9:15 now. 9:15 p.m. So if you need to do that, then that's when you can head out. So Jisoo, first I'd like to kick things off. Welcome. Welcome to New Zealand.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And as always, it's always good to be in New Zealand. I feel like the air is different here. It's like cleaner, probably crisper. You guys could probably like bottle that up and sell it, you know, export it out.
I think this is going to go really well. I love where you're coming yeah. from. Can we start off? I think we've all had that situation. You're speaking to someone about a topic and then an ad for it appears on one of your feeds and you're like, oh my goodness, my phone is listening to me. Jisoo, are our phones listening to us?
In some ways, yes. So if you have a smartphone and you have a virtual assistant like Siri, Bixby, Alexa, Cortana, the list goes on, it is listening to you. It's not particularly like with nefarious spy espionage kind of intent, but yeah, they are looking for trigger words, and sometimes you will just happen to conveniently see the world holiday that you've wanted to buy from Contiki suddenly on sale on your Facebook feed, and that's maybe a coincidence.
After you've been talking about it.
Yeah, exactly, with your friends, and maybe, but the whole point is, I guess, they kind of don't need to listen to you. Your phones don't actually need to listen to you because what you're actually putting out there through social media and through your phone is enough to profile you to the point where a lot of social media companies and the kind of companies that use ad revenue and use advertising through those platforms actually know what you're thinking and what you want to buy, like even just
through,
now.
I guess through your search function as well. That's immediately.
Right. Yeah. So you just kind of have to be really vigilant with the permissions that you're giving all your apps. And there's ways you can do this. You can easily Google, you know, iPhone or Android cleanup 2023 and see what you can kind of switch on and off. But it's really interesting to see what kind of has access to your messages, your calendar, your contacts, your microphone, your camera, your music, your audio, your videos and your images and all that good stuff.
Wow, that is...
Not to scare you. You have control though.
That's a significant amount of data. So what happens to that data? Where does it go?
So depending on what kind of permissions you have agreed to. So, you know, when you sign up for something and it comes with terms and conditions and no one ever reads them, unless you're a lawyer, I'm sure there's lawyers here that, you know, troll through all those. You basically are giving a lot of companies permission to collect, process, and store your data, depending on what it is that they want to use it for. Normally, you do kind of consent to it through these terms and conditions.
Which you don't read.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of people have done the reading for you, so sometimes it's a bit easy. But a lot of the time, they're using it for advertising, so micro-targeting. And this is not new. Like, this is just a different mode of doing it. It's a lot faster. It's a lot more sophisticated. It's a lot cheaper to do it. And basically, we're helping it happen because we just sign up for things. We download apps. We do just kind of give permissions. You turn on all the cookies when you're browsing. Like, please don't do that. Just reject the ones that you can reject. But essentially, yeah.
Can we just pause there? When you say you turn on all the cookies when you're browsing.
Turn them off.
Turn them off. So how might you go about that?
Yeah, so it's not a biscuit. It is that thing. It's essentially a piece of text that the website will kind of store on you, and it can range. It's very... I'll stop from being technical, but I'm not a technical expert anyway. But essentially, it can go from basically tracing and tracking, like if you've gone on a website and you've bought something, it might track exactly what you've bought, your size, if you're buying a dress or a pair of pants, how much you've actually spent, and all that kind of stuff. And then basically the website might hold on to it, maybe they'll trade it on. It just depends on what's going on. And then you'll see the interface with social media platforms, because then you might see the same website then advertising on your feed later. And so a lot of the time you're just telling the companies, hey, this is what I like. This is what I'm into. This is what I'll buy. This is what I'm thinking about buying. And so really it's just companies kind of commercializing that. And really it's just a smarter, more targeted form of advertising, which isn't new. It's just a new way of doing it. And it's way more personalized and invasive.
In a sense where we're, and this is a somewhat dramatic expression, but we're impaling ourselves on our desire for convenience. Because I think sometimes when some of us have seen this thing pop up, it's like, it's not, oh my goodness, they're following me. It's like, that's just what I wanted. How handy. I just wanted some fluffy slippers, and here they are. How it's taking advantage of our, I think, our human foibles.
Yeah, for
but,
sure.
But using them to commercialize and and commodify them.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm also seeing a lot of concerned looks in the crowd. So please, just know that there are data privacy laws that are protecting you to a degree. In Australia, we have the Privacy Act of 1988, and it was updated in 2014 with a series of principles, which essentially protected user data and how companies were to handle it, and how, and kind of like the industry standards around how to protect it. And then on top of that, in New Zealand, I understand that you guys had an update to your Privacy Act of 1993, and so you had an update in 2020, which was really good, and I think that gave more powers to your privacy commissioner to essentially go after violations and let people know when there have been data breaches, and basically like tighten up all the regulations around data privacy. So don't be scared.
However, I understand that there were some reports commissioned by government recently in New Zealand that found that, for example, the four major political parties were not using data privacy as they should have been doing. Have you heard about that?
I mean, Tim, it's just such a coincidence that I too read this report today.
It's not as if we rehearsed
as
this.
If we colluded on this together.
Oh my goodness, it's like I'm Meta. And your ex.
Yeah, that's right. So, from my understanding, the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet here did commission two reports and two studies, basically, to see if there was misinformation, disinformation, or any kind of foul play around the elections this year. And they did find that voters that visited all four of those political parties' websites didn't get, like, a notice about whether or not they would be traced via cookies. And so that is apparently a thing that is required. I'm not the expert on this, so please, if someone knows something, please let me know. But essentially, you're meant to be compliant with at least notifying the user that they are being kind of traced. And so, yeah, that didn't happen. And all four of them were in the red. So in some ways, it's democratic.
However, the minority parties, they're very, very big on data privacy. Right? Who knows?
No, I have no idea.
I'm just taking it somewhere. Look, you've written a great article in the latest Flint and Steel, edition number 10. It's the 10th anniversary one, 1195 over there. It's about mis and disinformation in many ways and the way it's used commercially. But can you throw some light on, you can throw a bit of light on that, but I think you have done, but also how it's being used by non-commercial actors. Just unpack that a bit for us.
Yeah, firstly, I just want to say, Flint and Steel, this edition, was amazing. I read it because I was jet lagged. I'm like, my body thinks it's like 5 hours behind right now. So I was like reading this at 1 a.m. in one sitting. I had an advanced digital copy. Thank you, Jason. And I read it in one sitting and didn't go to sleep. And I really enjoyed it. There were really some great articles, great common themes. So I just want to give that a bit of a plug. In saying that, yes, my article...
We didn't rehearse that either, I promise you.
Was that the talking point? No. No, in my article, it's actually just a really kind of a taster for a lot of the general population who might not know about misinformation, disinformation, particularly that's floating around on social media. Because now it's getting to a point... where there's a lot of fake news, and fake news has been around for a very long time, before Donald Trump even came up with the term, right? So, you know, it's been around, but now it's becoming a little bit more insidious because technology, which is the main vehicle for disinformation, misinformation, and I just want to clarify very quickly, misinformation is just false news, but it has no malign intent and it doesn't seek to harm, whereas disinformation is deliberately deployed to cause harm through deception and through falsehoods. So with misinformation, disinformation, it's very easy nowadays to just like, anyone can be a publisher now. Anyone can upload a view, an opinion, and then it just takes a bit of like it being out of context or being promoted through an algorithm to suddenly become viral.
And thus gain credibility.
Yeah, in many ways, yeah, because if you're like, oh, a lot of people are sharing this. So in my article, I talk about a particular case during the Israel-Hamas conflict. So as we know, that's been happening since the 7th of October. It's not going to comment on how awful it is, but apart from that, there was basically news reports by credible news sources that said that Israel had bombed a hospital in Gaza. And it basically came out of a tweet where someone who was representing the Hamas-run health ministry said that, oh, Israel has bombed a hospital. And so from there, the BBC picked it up, the New York Times picked it up, a lot of credible news outlets picked this story up and they started running with it. That day was like hard on Israel, I suppose, because they got all this international condemnation. Like a lot of people are now thinking like, oh, well, do I support Israel? Like a lot of countries whose foreign policy position was to support Israel, like they were then becoming a bit, you know, a bit shaky. Anyway, that day was also when Joe Biden was visiting Tel Aviv and he basically said, well, US intelligence assessments say it wasn't Israel, and Israel had obviously come out and said it as well. So basically, long story short, it took a very long time for the news cycle to correct itself because by the end of the following news day, the BBC, the Times, all the kind of news outlets that had run these headlines had basically retracted and apologized and said, sorry, we shouldn't have gone and just tweeted, well, basically headlined this tweet.
Yeah.
We're sorry. So beyond commercial interest now.
Correct. And I think we're also in an in-between period where we're seeing the ascendancy of digital media platforms. And I use that term very loosely. But you're also seeing declining legacy media. When I say legacy, I mean print, radio, TV. You know what I mean. Those the business models for those legacy media operations are collapsing. Because advertising, which is essentially the lifeblood of any business, any media organisation, is migrating to digital platforms because that's where the eyeballs are. You look at TikTok, for example, there's 26 billion people on TikTok. Well, that's where the action is. And so because there's less money coming into those legacy organisations, they're increasingly reliant on digital platforms to furnish the news, the information that is their bread and butter. The other aspect is the speed of digital media puts greater, I guess, pressure on those organizations to compete. So to be the fastest to the headline. And you're also, because the business model's collapsing, you're not seeing the usual checks and balances. So in an old-fashioned newsroom, there would be some guy with a half-empty bottle of scotch and an overflowing ashtray going, did this really happen? Maybe I'll do that voice again. Did this really happen? Get back to your desk and find me four sources. Oh, no, it was just a tweet. That's not going to work in the old model, but there's neither the time nor the infrastructure to assess information currently.
Yeah, that's right. And Tim, there's a couple of things that I can comment on here. So we talked about data before, because essentially how social media works is it will serve you up what you like, or maybe what you might be interested in, basically based on what you're liking, what your friends might be liking, and other things that the algorithms are picking up. And so this is exactly the same as, like, we're all familiar with the term echo chambers. It's just basically you're creating an echo chamber, and this is not a new phenomenon. I know that a lot of people in this room know exactly what I'm talking about, because you've been living in one, probably, to some degree, over the last 5 to 8 to 10 years. So, but basically, they can profile you so well that they can know if you're agreeable, if you have certain views and you're tending towards a certain view. So you open yourself up for a lot of influence. And so that's why now in the UK and the US, there was a survey done recently, and I think 82% of adults in the US support Israel over Hamas, for example. But apparently in the 18 to 24-year-old cohort, it's not that high. And it's largely because of TikTok. And obviously...
So when you say not that high, my understanding is actually pretty much the reverse.
Yeah, I think it's something like 18% or something. Like I did hear that in passing.
81% would support. Let's say Palestine. If we're going to structure it that way, but by implication, Hamas.
Yeah, exactly. So it's that's because nowadays, like, social media is becoming a news source, and it's not just social media; it's TikTok. And TikTok isn't really the classic media kind of format. You're not reading through critical arguments. It's not giving you who, what, when, where, why. It's not giving you the full picture, the full context. It's literally a 10 to 15 second video that can now be manipulated. And that comes to my second point. With the advent of AI, but also just in general, we have so much multimedia out there. There's been basically debunking of TikTok videos, social media posts where people are saying, look what Israel's doing to Hamas. And they're like, well, that's actually a clip from a video game, or that's actually a clip from the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. Like, it's completely miscaptioned. It's completely misconstrued. And so that is a clear example of disinformation, because it seeks to do harm, or it seeks to manipulate people's views, and it seeks to manipulate reality. So with AI now, you have generative AI. It's becoming more and more sophisticated. If I wanted to, I could now go and generate through AI three portraits of people, and you might never know that they're real. That they're real or not, because it looks like literally a photo. Like, we had, I think, earlier this year, the photography awards, the global ones, literally an AI generated image won, and everyone was like, "Is this kosher?" And everyone was like, "No." So yeah, it's just becoming, it's getting to that point where now, really malicious actors could do a lot of harm.
And to that point, it's actually we're in a situation where, okay, so there's the context of no context, because you're simply looking at a series of images, and also there is the fact that you're questioning what is reality, or you need to be questioning what is reality, and this is almost a philosophic and theological question, that when you're just sort of doom scrolling through your phone, you're not actually equipped to engage with. There was the situation in Turkey recently where a fake pornographic video of one of the Turkish candidates emerged. And that's the other thing, is you watch, again, time is the issue, and this emerged very, very close to the election, within days of the election. That person, it was a fake AI-generated video, but that candidate had to pull out.
Yeah, and that's not the first time like something like that has happened in politics. Like in India, the youngest female parliamentarian ever elected there, she, just before polling day, like a few days before, there was a deep fake pornographic video that came out of her, and everyone, she was basically tarred and feathered. Particularly in India, you've got like such a, you know, dynamic mentality around sexuality and all that kind of stuff. So there, it was just bad, obviously, but now we're getting to a point where even in the Russian-Ukrainian war, like 3 weeks after the illegal invasion, there was all of a sudden this video of Zelensky, and he was saying, "Everyone, put your arms down. We don't want to go to war. Let's just have peace." And a Ukrainian media outlet kind of, you know, picked that up, and the news strap kind of implied that maybe he had fled the country, and he was saying, "Let's just call for peace." Turned out it was a deep fake video that the Russians had injected into the social media sphere of Ukraine. And yeah, like, I guess media outlets who might not know, they just picked it up and they wanted to run with it.
Or may not have the equipment to go, oh, wait a minute. And the other thing I will say, and this is no discredit, but as newsrooms become younger, they become less experienced. So that individual and... it could be a man or a woman with the half-empty scotch and the overflowing ashtray, has the benefit of experience. If it smells or sounds fake, then possibly it is. It's not the same, not necessarily in a new sense, the same acuity. But I will say, I want to strike a hopeful note here. There's a thing called the Edelman Trust Barometer that comes out every year, and it assesses trust levels within nations and compares them globally. And New Zealanders are actually world beaters at distrusting social media. So pat yourselves on the back, Kiwis. That's a positive. It's not a reason for complacency, but it is a positive positive piece of information. In the interests of, because we are all about being hopeful, in the interests of positivity and hopefulness, what are other countries doing about this? Are there any examples that we can look to, Jisoo?
Yeah, so in 2007, there was basically a three-week-long cyber attack that Russia did on Estonia, which is a population of about 1.3 million people, and that was like... they took out like government services, like media, like all basically online services were suspended for 3 weeks with distributed denial of service attacks. This is like the case study of the first kind of cyber warfare attack, state on state in cyberspace. And Estonia, instead of kind of rolling over and being like, right, that's it, we're going offline, we're not doing this, they dug their heels in and they said, you know what, we're going to put everything online, we're going to be really smart about it, we're going to have multiple points of failure instead of centralizing all of our digital servers. Basically, they chucked everything online. They're a digital first nation and they're really kind of piloting the way. And they now have this program, since 2010, actually, they've put it into all public schools in Estonia from kindergarten plus. They have like digital literacy programs, and there's also like a 35-hour mandatory media and influence course that all the kids have to do. And essentially, it's not the government telling them what's right and wrong, it's just giving them the skills to be like, well, this is the digital media landscape, and these are the potentially the actors that might be there. And it basically.
So, for example, I see something. Does it then run you through what you could do to verify it?
I mean, I personally haven't done the course. I think I'd love to do it. But I think it, from what I've read, it's very much about critical thinking. It's like actually upskilling the critical thinking part of children when they go online particularly. And it's also about the safety part of it as well. And I think at the end of the day, they don't do it just for children. They've done it for, I think they provided 10% of their population with free digital literacy education, and then everyone else kind of can have their own rollout through, you know, work or whatever it is. And particularly for elderly people, you know, they were kind of bringing them on for the along for the ride. So I think there is a model there. It's very interesting, particularly as governments go digital, and particularly like in Australia, a lot of our services are now online. We have, you know, Medicare. I can do my taxes online. I've got digital identity, all that kind of stuff. And so I think the future isn't being more insular and being scared of change, it's actually taking control and harnessing the power and making sure that we do stay on top of it. I'd rather be educated about what's happening online than regulating, than the government regulating it first without me completely understanding what's happening. So there's a lot of tools out there, even without a government rolling it out, that you can learn more about data privacy and all that kind of stuff. And
can I just jump in? Because in terms of... we at Maxim, we've been looking into artificial intelligence, and New Zealanders have a very, we're a bit technologically averse. For example, just before the coalition agreement was announced, there was a study by Westpac Bank about artificial intelligence and the benefits of it, and it's the usual mantra, which is greater competition, greater profitability, better opportunities to become responsive to customers. The finding of the bank was that most New Zealand businesses are ambivalent about picking up artificial intelligence because they're too small and too operationally driven, which means they can't get out of the cycle they're in to actually engage with this technology. So my question, Jisoo, there's actually, there are studies, there was a global study last year that said that Australia and New Zealand are the slowest in the world at picking up artificial intelligence. There's a certain technological aversion we have. Is that a defence, do you think, or is it a disadvantage?
I don't know. I think for us, obviously, you know, Australia, New Zealand, we're all in the far corners of the world. We kind of like how things are, and we kind of, you know, live in our own little pockets of paradise. And it's
that
nice.
The tyranny of distance.
That's
the
right.
Geographical defence.
That's right. But I don't think maybe there are pros and cons to everything, right? The pro is that we get to see how other people do it, how other countries do it, and we get to learn from their mistakes. Like the European Union and a lot of like the UK and the US have been on the leading edge of kind of AI. But just recently, you know, there was the Global AI Summit, the first of its kind, and it's just good, I guess, for us to even just go along and just see what's happening. I know Natasha Bolas wrote an article on this recently, and go check
an
it out.
Excellent, excellent column.
Great column, loved it. And a podcast as well, amazing.
Maxim.org.nz.
That's right, and on any podcasting platform. Yeah, that's right.
But actually Natasha made a really, and I was actually lumping New Zealand and Australia in together in terms of a certain technological aversion. At least Australia was at Bletchley Park to sign up along with these other 28 international actors. We didn't even go.
I think we're organising a debrief with you guys later. I think maybe that's what happened. So, yeah, that's probably
thanks
what
thanks a lot. We'll bring the sandwiches.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, and obviously the con, though, is that if we're kind of not even participating in the creation of AI technologies, then we actually don't really know how to play properly. It's kind of like when you get an IKEA flat pack and you just skip the instructions, but you just use it and you try and put it together. It's not the same thing. You just don't know how to localize it for your context. You actually don't know how to use it for your benefit, that benefits your people. So I would encourage everyone to at least just have a gander. Like ChatGPT is a great little tool. Definitely if you're a student, please don't plagiarize and use it to write your essays. But, you know, there's a lot of great ways to use it. You can actually bring three really complex ideas that you've originated yourself and ask ChatGPT to synthesize it in a way that just helps with writer's block sometimes. Or if you even just need to start designing a very basic thing, you can just, you know, use a generative AI image kind of tool and go from there. So there are definitely pros. I think it's not beneficial to kind of hide away and be like, this is it, this is the end of the world. Because we, as responsible citizens, we need to be there to actually help prevent any decline or any abuse. We need to be there at the forefront and also protecting our children, protecting our rights.
And that's your view, in essence, too, on social media, isn't it? That you can't just disconnect, but to use it well and be able to construct an orderly response to it rather than careening from one dopamine hit to the other. I'm going downbeat again. I need to go upbeat.
Hopeful.
Let's go hopeful. So how might a good social media response look?
Yeah, I mean, so if you read the magazine, there's some very helpful articles on how to engage on social media. I kind of talk more about how you can check content for misinformation, disinformation. They're very basic tools. In fact, there's a lot of stuff out there that you don't need to read my article for that.
Give me one tool. How would I do it? So I see something. Oh, my goodness. Is this true? What do I do next?
Yeah, well, a lot of the time, fake news sites. So it's been known that the BBC has actually been duped before, as in people
what?
Have
really,
as in people have created fake BBC websites and fake BBC posts and basically said like, look at what the BBC has reported. Sometimes it's very, very like subtle. Like you can check the URL, and sometimes it will say, you know, www.bbbc.com, and that's when you're like, okay, I don't think this is real. It's, you know, it's just little things like that. You can check the content, and if it's making some wildly unsupported claims, you can probably then be like, okay, maybe look at the author, look on their Twitter account, is it fake? Oh, look, they've been posting about Indian cricket matches, and now they're posting about Israel Hamas. Like, this is a big jump. Yeah. It's normally an indicator that something sketchy is happening.
Okay. Well, there you are. That's a little a tip, a hint. We're at the end, I think, of our conversation, Jisoo. But for you, the conversation just begins because we're going to take a break. But we want you to offer questions. We're because we're so tech friendly here at Maxim, we're going to use Slido. Questions will be displayed. You can vote for them. Also, you can use your QR code. So what you do is you scan the QR code, you get on the site, you type in your question. We're going to publish, as I say, a selection of the questions. So again, if it's inappropriate, but you know, you knew that already, but mostly we'll take the questions and we'll pick the ones that get voted up. And
but I did realize we didn't actually finish that question on how to engage social media. Like, so let's still end on the hopeful note.
Okay, and then we'll go to
questions. Yep. So I think yes, if you need to detox social media, do it. I'm actually for that. I'm pro logging off, pro deleting your account.
You gave up your Instagram account.
I did. It's the best thing I've ever done, never going back on that cesspool ever again. But basically, not that there's great content on there, it's just a time waster. But basically how we can use social media, it's to kind of promote the things, like actually promote the things that we stand for in a democracy. Like having a contest of ideas is healthy. Engaging in debate is healthy. Meeting people that you would normally not talk to and connecting with them is healthy. But it's also being really cognizant of the fact that just because you have friends and connections and followers doesn't necessarily mean you are known. And so when you're engaging with people on you know, a post and it turns into a very aggressive debate, it's fine. It's not a reflection of you. This person doesn't actually know you. So I think it's just good to kind of keep, just stand strong on your identity. And
but I think tone is crucial. So do not descend into, you know, if someone says something that's provocative, you don't need to respond.
Yeah.
Even though every molecule in your body is screaming for you to
100%.
Go. Because this person isn't in front of you. So it's almost, you're in a situation where it's a disinhibition situation. Don't succumb to that.
Yeah, there is a way to maintain, you know, decorum and a level of politeness, but still engage in debate. And that's what a lot of, you know, Western liberal democracies are actually seeing a huge degradation of. Like, if we look at the US, the polarization of politics, people literally cannot have Thanksgiving dinner with their families anymore because of politics. And that is really sad to see. So I think there is a way for us to maintain some norms on social media in cyberspace.
Yeah, if it feels like, you know, that cheap sarcasm that makes you go, ooh, probably don't post it. Just, you know, turn to your spouse and go, huh, I said this, I was going to say this thing, but I restrained myself. And they'll be going, what? Sorry, what did you say? Kidding, that's not, I'm not describing, geez, so awkward. Let's go to Q&A, shall we? So again, it's Slido, scan that. You can then ask questions. You've got 5 minutes. We'll get back into the questions after that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Hello. Hello, hello, hello. Exciting discussions, debates, engagement, ferment. I love it. Listen, thank you so much, and don't hesitate to vote for the question that you like the most or that reflects your area of interest. Keep voting. We're going to do this for another 20 minutes. So the first question, which is really getting some traction, is who counts as an authority to determine what is information and mis or disinformation, Jisoo?
Not the government, I'd say, or a single source of truth. My view is that it should always come from a collective, just like with any good news story, anything that happened, it should be corroborated, it should be backed by evidence, and it should be truthful.
How do you assess that evidence?
Well, I think it is hard now because when you have images and video, you're like, well, is this real? But there are some tools online now, and also you will always have, hopefully, eyewitnesses. Look, we're probably moving into a future where eyewitnesses might never become a thing. But I think objectively, there's always going to be reality. And I think we have to just find anchor points as a collective where we agree that these are the rules of engagement for information distribution, and this is also the rules of engagement for how we consume media, and that's on us to actually embody. Like, we should probably slow down with how much information we're consuming. We're giving almost godlike powers to ourselves by being on the internet, and we don't have godlike wisdom nor the omnipresence or the omniscience that is actually required to be God. So sometimes we just have to come face to face with the fact that we're finite beings, and it is actually okay not to know everything and not to know the latest headline or the breaking news on the news strap and being able to tell everybody about it. So I think that's kind of stemming from that question, taking a bit of a tangent, but that's how we should be doing it. Not trusting the government, particularly in democracies where governments can change, to become the single source of truth.
I wonder too if it's good to ask yourself, so who benefits from the narrative that this story is asserting? And that will help you determine whether it's something that's being deployed tactically or strategically.
Which story?
Well, whatever you're examining. So you say, for example, the story about the hospital bombing. So who benefits from that? Okay, if Hamas benefits from that, and Hamas is a terror organization, I'm just using that as an example, then I need to find some other corroboration. So I think we do come to things with an understanding of what institutions are valid, and we should retain that, but we also need to be open to motivation when we're consuming information. Why is this information here? Why has it come all the way to little old me down in the bottom of the world? What is the narrative below the narrative here?
Yeah, and I think if we can no longer trust, like have public trust and confidence in our institutions or in reputable media sources, then that's going to be a problem. And how do we maintain trust and confidence in those entities? Well, it's actually up to us to keep journalists accountable. Like there was some city in the US where if the local rag, if a journo, like, you know, misled or misreported something, their article literally got cut out and put on a corkboard in the local bar, and everyone would be like, hey, you're a loser. And so the public accountability thing is actually still a very strong mechanism, and that's what the Fourth Estate literally should be running on. They should obviously have integrity as journalists to actually report accurately and truthfully and in a balanced manner to give the people the news and the facts. But we as the people should also be keeping them accountable. And so if we do, we should be questioning them if it's kind of like, hey, why, what, where is this coming from? Like, this is not on brand for you guys. Like, what's going on?
Let's go to the next one. How is privacy law enforced, in particular with regard to overseas apps, pardon me, like TikTok and, is this Temu?
Temu.
Yeah, kind of like embarrassing.
Like an eBay, like like an Alibaba.
Thank you for translating, Jesus.
Yeah. So actually, this is an issue in Australia right now, because we found the Australian Strategic Policy Institute has recently done a report on disinformation, misinformation from foreign actors in Australia, and they detected that there were foreign actors, even during the voice referendum that we had recently, where foreign actors were sowing discord and further division, exacerbating it online. And it was like particularly through WeChat and TikTok. Now, the Australian Senate has released a report where they're basically trying to get them to come to those social media companies to come forward to give evidence at an inquiry, but they can't. They can't compel them to do that because they're not headquartered in Australia. There's no offices in Australia. They're all headquartered in China. So obviously it's falling on deaf ears, and it's actually you can't enforce Australia's legal privacy framework onto overseas actors unless they share the same legal frameworks and values as you. And so this
so
is
So you're saying you can't?
Well, I'm sure some very good lawyers might be able to. Some very smart, capable international lawyers might be able to. But it's very hard to compel a state-owned social media company with, you know, values that we don't share to come forward and give evidence or provide any kind of transparency about what they're doing with your data. Which is why, I mean, I think there was a podcast that Maxim did with Cecilia where basically she went through the terms and conditions that TikTok has, and I suggest you all listen to it if you haven't already. Because, yeah, it's kind of insidious what they can put in there and what you can agree to.
I guess what we're seeing with a global digital culture is the inability for nation states to regulate that, because it always is, or it is often headquartered in a different geographical locale. With even in the case, say, of Meta being brought before the US lawmakers, there's a struggle there. It seems pretty elusive. I don't know what the conclusion is or how they might be compelled. I know that in Australia, for example, there's social media companies are forced to have Australian legacy media content on their feeds. So news stuff, so that that's just part of the law. So if you want to do business here, that's how we do it. But if there's disinformation being spread, that's a different beast.
Yeah, and I think there's a study that shows that 1 in 5 videos on TikTok contain misinformation or disinformation. So there's just no way. That's a lot. If you're scrolling for an hour, that's a lot of videos that are fake that you are like consuming. So it's just something to keep in mind that you also have to think about your legal protections when you're using a certain app. And there are ways to compel Facebook in Australia to basically, you know, come before a parliamentary committee and to change laws and to change regulations and industry standards, but perhaps not the same in Beijing.
Jisoo, what's the best way to change from the narrative of doom to the narrative of hope and opportunity amongst everyday New Zealand, e.g. mums and dads?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to become overwhelmed with like the rapid acceleration of bad news in our lives, particularly how rapidly technology is changing, and with the social cohesion landscape changing, with politics changing, everything's changing. It's very easy to become overwhelmed, and I think social media and digital media can make it worse. And so for me, I think I want to take a quote from Jonathan Haidt. He's an American sociologist. Some of you might know his work. He's written The Coddling of the American Mind, and he's basically looked at how politics in America has become completely polarized, and he's looking at why. But he says, like, you can't be known and grow up in networks. You can only be known and grow up in communities. And I think that's true. In essence, we're humans. We need to have face-to-face interactions. We all saw during COVID lockdown how that degraded mental health, how that caused incredible ripping apart of our social fabric. And so I think it's time to go back and restore the kind of human connection. I think it's so easy to be like, I have heaps of friends because I have 90 followers on this post. It's like, no, you actually have probably 5 really good friends by the time you're 30 who know you and you've grown up with them in community that you can pick up the phone to, and they can encourage you and edify you and keep you grounded. And I think if you just, basically my message is put your social media, like, don't be afraid to log off. Like, don't be afraid to do the countercultural thing and detox. And be afraid to miss out. I don't understand when FOMO, like, became a thing. It's obviously a marketing ploy. But I just think take a detox and just be known in your communities. Find out what's actually happening out there. And you can do that through volunteering. You can do that even just by, like, sitting at your local cafe and people watching. It's, like, it's just so nice. You can do it by traveling. You can actually see, like, oh, is America that dangerous? Am I going to be shot on arrival? No, because I went to New York and I was fine. I, like, came out of it. It was fine. I mean, I've been to New York since before the plague, but that's okay. but this is that's the point. Like, live in the world that we're actually in.
Yeah, yeah. And I would also say, in terms of the, you know, the social media that you do consume, I mean, we are at the... We try and eat healthy food. We don't always succeed, but we try and eat healthy food. So again, the intellectual and spiritual nourishment that you get from, and yeah, the platters are pretty good here, by the way. And they're healthy too, right? Absolutely. What I'm saying is good stuff nourishes you. Good stuff builds you up. Consume that. The other point I would make too, Jisoo, is in the friendships you make. Choose the friendships and the interactions that will nourish you. I think take the long view. Will this relationship be here in 5 years, and where will it be? Will these be people who can actually hold me to account, but also build me up when I need to be built up?
Yeah, 100%. And I think Jonathan Haidt says something else. Like, he basically said social media platforms went from social networking systems to more performative social media platforms around 2010. And that has had a detrimental effect on youth and on young people. And I consider myself to be very fortunate that my generational cohort still knows what it's like to play outside without a phone, never have a phone on us, like, all that kind of stuff. I think bring that back in your households, like, for those who have children, who have young people. Like, it's Jonathan Haidt actually has a bit of, like, rules, like 4 rules, I think, and his research is actually really worth having a look into. But the other thing is, for those of you who might have seen The Social Dilemma on Netflix, really great documentary, worth having a look at as well. Tristan Harris, who is a former Google design ethicist, has now started the Center for Humane Technology. And he basically purports, you know, doing the logging off, doing the detox, like, taking off your shoes, going and, like, walking outside. It's like just doing the things that, like, 20 years ago would have been ridiculous to suggest as things to do for your mental health, because everyone was doing it anyway. So yeah, that's kind of like, I'm not sure if it fully answers that question.
And look, if you want to know more about social media virtues, there's an article by Jason Heal in the latest Flint Wowie. And Steel. Oh my goodness, and it's not social media, it's a tangible thing, it's an artifact. You can take it with you, hold it in your hands and read it with your eyes. Anyway,
that is very important as well. Being able to read books and being able to, like, not reply back to someone as soon as possible, that is actually a real important part of cognitive development and just all around having civic responsibilities and being able to grow those skills.
Okay, the next one is, we've talked a bit about TikTok. Well, let's just dig into this very quickly because we're short on time. TikTok is an open source platform. Traditional media caters to shareholder interests. That's when they make a dividend to actually pay the shareholders, but that's by the by. Do you think TikTok spreads agendas more than traditional media does?
I would just say the mode of delivery is just different. There's still shareholder interests on social media because ad revenue is for companies. And companies often have boards and shareholders and all that good stuff. But for how it's basically disseminated, like the agenda, pushing an agenda.
Are you saying in a sense, I mean, Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. So the fact that it's compressed, the fact that it is separated from context, all of that stuff creates an environment that then an agenda comes from that.
Yeah, I think there was a study, I think maybe by MIT or something, but they basically found that posts or content with fake news, disinformation, misinformation in it was likely to be shared 23 times more than true news. And that's because of the sensationalism, but also just how quick it is now to share things. And now there's obviously, you know, I think WhatsApp now limits you on how much you can send to how many people at any one time. So my mum no longer sends me chain messages about how frozen lemons can prevent cancer, all that kind of stuff. But it just means because you can share it so quickly, the speed of information, it's actually slowing down our, it's not giving us enough space to have critical thinking, to apply critical thinking to it. So that's why it's going back to that point of like just being able to slow down because yes, agendas can create traction anywhere. This isn't new. We're humans. We have been subjected to a lot of different influences over civilization and eras. But the whole point is that now we have these devices that are lightning fast and you can find out anything at any time and you can tell anyone you want and you have access to like, you know, 2/3 of the world's population in the palm of your hand. And I think that is a power that requires a lot of wisdom. And so I think we just need to, yeah, slow down, be okay with not sharing the latest breaking news. In saying that, finding good news subscription services that you can trust that kind of just give you like an inbox worth of curated news at the end of every day is really useful, I find. So yeah, just
okay.
There are tools out there.
Essentially, to go back to the metaphor you used, you are not a god. Don't try and behave like one. Stop it. Put the phone down. Go and take your socks off, walk across some grass and talk to someone whom you don't like, but do it face to face. Thank you, Jisoo.
Thanks for listening to the Maxim Institute podcast. If you'd like to hear more from us and keep up with the rest of our research and analysis of politics and policy in New Zealand, you can sign up on the homepage of our website to get our monthly forum email and invitations to future Maxim Institute events. You can search and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. From the team at Maxim, mā te wā, goodbye for now.